ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Clint Jasper, and you're listening to A Big Country. Thanks for joining me. This week, we're getting the lowdown on little beetles that do a big job on farms. Dung beetles are so prized for their ability to fight parasites, fertilise soil and break down dung that farmers are now breeding their own beetles in on-farm nurseries. We'll head along to a cooking class where regional chefs are sharing their top tips and helping home cooks make food go further in the face of cost of living pressures. And a lifelong love of goats. We'll meet a grazier in her 70s who says her animals are her passion and purpose.
I got my first goat when I was 7. That was a Sanando. So that little girl went everywhere with me through the bush with the cattle dogs, and she followed me just like a little person, you know. Everyone thinks I'm probably a bit silly. At least if when you get up, you've got something to do. My father used to say to me, girl, if you stop work, you die. So you just get up and you keep going.
Still going along with her beloved goats, we'll meet that longtime farmer and goat breeder and some of her new baby kids. That's coming up. First today, we're heading to a pub in North Queensland where little string instruments are creating important social connections. Jason Katsaris has the story.
There's a four-string revolution secretly taking over the country, one song at a time. Ukulele clubs have flourished in popularity in the last 15 years, with over 100 clubs now active across every state and territory. But unlike some music clubs, there's very little prerequisites to joining.
What we're trying to establish is embracing. It's a social community group. We don't charge anything.
That's Coley Battalini. She's been playing ukulele around North Queensland for years. Every Tuesday, a rotating cast of around 50 players visit the local pub in Townsville and sing songs together. Each player brings their own ukulele, facing a projector showing songs, lyrics and chords.
It's wonderful. It's just a community activity. Tuesday nights for people to come and have a sing, have a play, have a meal, have a laugh, have a chat, have a drink.
For a lot of the players here, the ukulele is their first and only instrument. But what is it about this small, unassuming instrument that draws people in?
It's a very simple instrument. Starting price ukulele is about $30. And with a $30 ukulele and four chords that they teach the beginners, you can play 10,000 songs. There's really no limit to what you can play with a ukulele.
That's Kent Dungable, a truck driver in Townsville turned uke enthusiast.
Your body will release endorphins while you're singing, so you get this euphoria, and the gland that releases the endorphins doesn't understand good singing and bad singing, so no matter how bad you sing, you still get the hit. You're guaranteed.
Beyond the music, the impacts these clubs have on their members can't be overstated, and it's changing lives.
First instrument ever. Always wanted to play a guitar, but it's too many chords for my old hands, so this is fitting really well.
Across town at another ukulele club, Rosie McAuliffe has been playing for a couple of years.
After I retired from aged care for 17 years for doing dementia, I was sitting at home doing nothing, and a friend suggested playing a ukulele and joining, she knew I sang, and to join a singing group, and they also learned to play the ukulele. I started that because I was home alone, a single mum, and my daughter had just joined the Navy, so I missed her a lot and couldn't see her through that with the COVID.
She says she's found a community of friends through the ukulele club.
If you're feeling down, they'll pick you up, you know, and they can see when you're having a bad day, and they're all just loving and caring. And I don't have family in Queensland at all, so they're my family.
Cheryl Green, a ukulele enthusiast and mental health nurse, can relate. The South Australian co-authored an editorial on the benefits of the ukulele in the International Journal of Mental Health Nursing. She says ukulele clubs should be included in community health professionals' toolbox of treatment.
And we know that connecting with people is good for us, good for our mental health, good for our self-esteem, good for our sense of self, good for developing support so that if our mental health challenges become stronger, we've got a network of people and friends and family around us that helped to support us through tough times and helped to give us joy in the good times.
She says it's no surprise ukulele clubs are proving so popular around the country.
It's affordable. You can learn to play a song in an hour. So it's highly accessible. I'm not a teacher, but I could teach somebody how to play the ukulele and have them playing four songs in an hour or two. And I'm no teacher. It's just because I play. Because it's the chord structure. It's quite simple. It's a very simplified way of being able to play a musical instrument, much simpler than the guitar, and let's not even go to piano and some of those others.
Adelaide-based ukulele teacher Richard Tonkin has people visiting his family's hotel to play ukulele weekly, with ages ranging from 17 to 70. He says he's enjoyed teaching music to people who never thought they'd be able to play.
Having fun is sort of intrinsic to the nature of the instrument. You can pass on musical knowledge very quickly on a simple instrument, and people get it, and they can get the songs and get all the chords. They feel really empowered. I really think that it's something that for a lot of people they thought that they would not be able to do beforehand. I think for a lot of people who have retired, it's an amazing thing for them, because you know, when they've been working all their lives and they've been looking around for a hobby afterwards, and the people go out and find a ukulele and they've never played music in their lives, they sit down and they can do it. And it's, I really think it's actually something very meaningful in their lives.
In this kitchen in regional New South Wales, local chefs are sharing their skills to help others. They're running cooking classes and teaching skills to help people get the most out of their groceries as the cost of food increases.
Everyone should be cooking, kids, elderlies, everyone. Why? First, because it's very social. For me, it's about socializing and enjoying ourselves, having fun. Thirdly, it's about, offer to your family something nutritious, something good. I think we end up going into fast food for a little bit of laziness, but we can do better. We need to try to be better. I think the key for me of these classes is to talk about what we call cocina de aprovechamiento in Spanish, which in English is the zero waste food, okay? Use, reuse, don't waste anything.
Hello, I'm Lauren Bohane. I'm chatting with Ruben Lopez Mesa, who has just wrapped up his second free cooking class, working alongside fellow chef Alison Karboviak. The pair are teaching classes focused on helping people to cut costs and reduce waste, while putting tasty meals on the table.
Being in Orange, we're a food region, so there's lots of really high-end stuff, but actually there's lots of people here who, yeah, that's not accessible to for, you know, heaps of reasons. So really it's about giving them a bit of excitement about food. So we're both very passionate about the food we do, and if people can learn to cook themselves and build more confidence in their cooking, their health outcomes are just enormous. So to encourage them, use real ingredients. It doesn't have to be intimidating or overwhelming, and particularly with food care. So there's access to cheap foods and also free ingredients. But it can be a bit overwhelming sometimes to go into that shop. So if they can walk away just with a couple of ideas of, hey, I can use these fresh veggies, I can use these eggs, and I can create something for myself at home, it's such a more positive way rather than having to rely on processed foods from the supermarket.
The pair have volunteered their time to teach the classes, which have been organised by Mission Australia and Food Care Orange, a social enterprise offering cheap and free groceries to those who need them. Food Care volunteer Sue Clark says there's been a significant increase in people seeking out the organisation's services.
So earlier in the year, we would have had around about 360, 370 people a month coming through, and we're now well up over 800 a month coming through the door. And it's a cross-section of the community. You know, I can't say to you, oh, it's mostly this people or those people. It's a real cross-section of the community. And we want people to feel comfortable enough to come. I think everybody's experiencing harder times these days, and to see some people coming through the door and being able to afford to get some food where they can cook these wonderful meals. And the positive thing is that food care is really focused on trying to promote healthy eating and reducing food waste, let me say. So when people come to food care, they just spend $8 in the supermarket. And once they've spent up to $8, that's the minimum, they can then access the free stuff that we provide. And fresh fruit and vegetables are a really important part of that free stuff that we try and keep up.
Healthy, affordable eating is at the heart of Ruben and Alison's classes.
Just because you're suffering financial hardship doesn't mean you have worse skills, but you just don't have the level of resources that somebody else can do by getting HelloFresh or eating out or whatever it might be. So it's really even more important that we arm people with the skills necessary to help alleviate that financial hardship. The communication out there is so much about don't spend time, cooking is a waste of time here, these are easy options for you, easy processed food, just use a packet and cook. And people are disempowered and they worry about, oh, well, if I'm not following this particular recipe or I'm not following these pack instructions, then I'm going to do it wrong. So it's giving them permission to explore and experiment and fall in love with food again, hopefully. Yeah.
Food care has been blown away by the response from those coming along and the community more broadly.
Everybody that has been involved to date has just loved it and learnt a lot. And even people who know how to cook, they've said that they've learnt lots of little ideas and it's been really useful for them.
Orange resident Jo Orr is one such attendee. She says she came along hoping to learn how to cook some easy meals.
It was different. Somehow it was different. He reached out to all of us and asked this one to try this, and that you felt that you were part of the action. And it was wonderful. All these little tips that we have learned, all about the fresh vegetables, raw vegetables. You knew that you could cope with a lot of that. You just have to put it into practice.
Will you be cooking some of these meals at home?
Definitely. Not as well, but I will definitely try.
For Alison and Ruben, that's all that matters.
At the end of the day, it's A, have fun, B, try everything that we said, you know, so you can understand, oh, wow, you know what, it won't be the same, but I'm going to give it a try. If we can motivate people, I think for me is the most important thing.
As the current run of classes nears its end, organisers are looking towards next year.
The key challenge for us is to make sure that the people who need to access the classes can access the class, are aware of the classes and actually also take the step of coming along, because no matter what support we get, if the people we're trying to target don't come along, then it's a waste of everybody's time and resource. So that's really, after our third class, we'll sit down and review how things and what's gone on and what people's feedback is, and then really have a think about what's the best way to approach it for next year, to ensure that we can still meet the needs of those who really need it. We can't do anything about the economy. We can't do anything about people's incomes or things like that. But if we can just give them a few skills to help them better navigate the food space, that'd be awesome.
As for this year, the classes have been labelled a success.
I'm just so thrilled that these people have been able to come along and enjoy this. You know, to see their faces when we were sitting down trying it all. It's just, for me, I drive away with a big smile on my face. So how lucky am I?
Okay.
Food Care Orange volunteer Sue Clark ending that report by Laura Bohane in Central West New South Wales. You can read more on that story. You'll find it on the ABC homepage. Head to abc.net.au and search for A Big Country. I'm Clint Jasper with you for A Big Country. Still to come, a breeding program for some beneficial beetles, and we're meeting Margaret Graham. The grazier from northern New South Wales is in her late 70s and still breeding goats. Her affection for the animals started when she was a little girl and continues today. Lara Webster has her story.
Come on. Where are you?
This is Violet's little baby, Henry. Yeah, isn't he lovely?
Beautiful.
Yeah.
She likes a cuddle.
Yeah, they do. They all like cuddles. You see, that's why they're so easy to handle, because I only have to call out and they all come to me. This is Amber's baby here. Gosh, she's heavy. Here's your bubby, isn't she? We've left the nursery and now this is where I've drafted does off that are close to kidding, so that when they kid, if they need assistance, I can put the gloves on and go. And hopefully they don't.
And who are some of the does we've got here? There's a few.
Oh, there's not many, but there's, yeah. These are the last of the does that are heavy and kid.
You do this on your own?
Yes.
Tell me how a day runs for you. I imagine it's, you know, go to woe for you.
Yes, it is. Oh, it is. Yes, yes. Everyone thinks I'm probably a bit silly, you know. But at least when you get up, you've got something to do. My father used to say to me, girl, if you stop work, you die. So you just get up and you keep going.
So tell me, what does a day look like for you?
Well, I sort of get out of bed, think, hello, I better feed the potties first. So I feed potties first and then come up, check those that are in kid, see what's going on. And then I do a big feed out at the behind the house with oats for about 120 does, and putting grain in troughs, you know, that sort of thing. And then do those, and then do the girls in the front paddock that got little weeny babies. Mix chaff and oats together, you know, and meg them in, and you know, all of that. And then put that out, and then come up to the nursery, do the girls there, do the boys that I've got locked up. I got my first goat when I was 7. That was a sarn and doe.
What do you remember of your first goat? Tell me about that first goat. Did the love story begin?
You will laugh, right? I always wanted a sister, right? My mother went away with her brothers down to a place called Werri Beach. Anyway, and she got out of the vehicle and came back, and she had this little sarn and doe, and she said, here's your sister. So that little girl went everywhere with me, through the bush with the cattle dogs, and she followed me just like a little person, you know.
How long were you together?
Oh, for about 14 years, yeah.
And tell me, how did the love then develop? I mean, you're so passionate about goats, and you've had them for so long now. Yeah. You've bred them for so long. What is it that's made you so passionate about them?
I don't know. Life would be, without them, it would be so difficult, I should imagine.
From that first goat when you were just a little girl to now, things have also changed a lot in terms of goats, markets, farming goats. There's been a lot of change.
Oh, of course there's been change. But I sort of had dairy goats, and I used to sell milk, not to humans, but greyhounds, because people always fed their greyhound pups the milk. And then boar goats sort of came out in about, I think it was 96 or something like that. And I thought to myself, it's hard work having a family and milking goats all the time. And so I thought, well, the boar goats would be a good thing. So, yeah, I went into breeding those and really loved it. And I crossed some with the dairy goats to see which would be the best crosses, and, you know, experimenting. Yeah, I found Toggenbergs were the best crosses because they had sort of a low body, sort of more built like a little house brick, so they had more meat on them than the Sarnans and the Nubians and things like that.
Marg, while we're standing here talking, you've got a doe behind us. Yeah. It's very close. That's to having great. Her kids. Yeah. It makes me think, how many kids have you helped deliver over your time?
Probably hundreds. You know, you swing them and get them breathing, and, you know, and they come to life. And I've also shown my grandchildren how you do this, and I've let them swing the baby when I've delivered it, and, you know, they think it's wonderful seeing new life.
Beef farmer Kylie Cook is overseeing an unusual breeding program. Along with other farmers on Western Australia's south coast, she is looking after a nursery producing new generations of dung beetles.
We've had a dung beetle program for the last 2 years, so we've been bringing in new species of beetle, which is going to fill the gaps in when the dung beetles are active. We're really fortunate that we've got a really active and well-established summer beetles here, which do a great job of burying the dung. And all the farmers know when the summer dung beetles have come out because they notice the flies have gone almost straight away. which is great for everybody, not just the farmers.
It's not just their ability to cut down on fly numbers that dung beetles are prized for. They could possibly be the best pound-for-pound farm worker in the world. In just one night, they can roll and bury livestock dung 250 times their own weight. Hello, I'm Sophie Johnson, and I'm chatting to farmer Kylie Cook. She is a member of the Wilson Inlet Catchment Committee, which has been helping farmers establish their own populations of beetles. She says dung beetles bring many benefits to farms.
They improve soil health, they're good for the animals' health as well because they're interrupting any parasite life cycles, also burying the nutrients so we can keep them on the farm and out of the waterways. Yeah, so for 2 years we've been releasing these dung beetles that are active in winter, and we've also brought in a spring active beetle which we're breeding up, ready to release now. That's a new one to WA.
So how many farmers have adopted using dung beetles on their property?
Oh, we've had a really great response locally. Yep, we've released 40 colonies so far. Some of those were within our project and some were extra because people were so keen to get more beetles for particular seasons that they wanted to get on top of the flies. So we did have some funding from the state government's Natural Resource Management Program, and that allowed us to get the winter active species Bubus bison, and that was the majority of the beetles that we brought in because they were already in Western Australia, so it was easier and more affordable to get them. I'm yet to find anyone who doesn't love dung beetles once they get to know about them.
In the past, Mark McHenry has relied on summer dung beetle varieties to clean up after his sheep, but just recently a nursery was set up on his property, allowing multiple species of dung beetles to breed, and some are even busy during the winter. Eventually, Mark hopes to have these super efficient farm workers employed all year round, and he sees huge financial and environmental benefits.
Well, it's an efficiency thing for us because we're always got a million things on, and if the dung beetles are doing my fertilising for me and improve my fertiliser use efficiency, that just makes a lot of sense. It's something I don't need to buy. It's something that doesn't make it into the water. It's just another job I don't need to do.
How much are the dung beetles going to save you, do you reckon?
I'm not sure exactly how much they would save us. In terms of fertiliser, we'd be able to assume they put a few tons of dung into the ground over the whole farm. So, I mean, at $1 a kilo for fertiliser, that's a few $1,000s a year, potentially. And it's also keeping it on farm rather than losing it down the river.
Now, you're breeding dung beetles here. How long have you been doing that for?
Not long. Kylie from Wick brought over some dung beetles. And I'm just following instructions. She's the expert. No one's done it to the level of detail that Wick's doing it now in this local region. So we can find out which species do well in which soil types under what farming regime. So, yeah, we just don't know. It's a bit of an experiment.
Did it cost you much to set up this breeding station here?
Not much. So we sort of are a host. So Wick was lucky enough to get some funding for that. So we're trialling how they go. Now, some people paid for their own. I can't remember what that was, but it's if you wanted to set up your own, you're probably looking at about, at a guess, $1,000 for the tent, depending on what you want to do. But you can always make it yourself. And then depending on which species of dung beetle you want to buy in, you're looking at between, like, not much and sometimes quite expensive, like $3 each. So it's hopefully we can generate greater populations so we can get lower cost beetles, just like any stock.
But boosting stock numbers doesn't happen overnight. Kylie Cook spends about a year nurturing and growing new dung beetle colonies before releasing them onto paddocks.
We bought a sort of a starter kit of the dung beetles that were new to WA. They'd been raising these beetles in South Australia for about 10 years. They've been doing similar to what we're doing here. We've got a little nursery set up where we have them in the paddock, that we feed them fresh cow dung once or twice a week, and they're covered in a little shade cloth cover so they can't fly away yet. And then when they've bred up, laid their eggs in the ground, the following year we hope that there'll be about 1,000 from the 100 that we started with, and once we've got 1,000 we can release them into the paddock, and that's enough to start a new population.
Beef farmer Kylie Cook from the Denmark area of Western Australia's south coast. She was speaking to reporter Sophie Johnson. You can see more on that story, including pictures of the dung beetles that Kylie and other farmers are breeding. You'll find all the details on the ABC homepage, abc.net.au. Look for A Big Country. That's the show for today. Thanks for listening, and I'll chat to you again next week.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.